house. We got to let them play. Hey, welcome to another edition of In and Out of Sports in the Coach's Corner with Coach Butch McAdams. And this show is sponsored in part by Horton's Funeral Services, Dr. Edward T. Buford, and the Athletic Republic. And as always, powered by our partners at the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. And that means my producer, my main man, golfer extraordinaire, Rick Hampton Sr. Well, once again, folks, we've got a treat for you in the Coach's Corner tonight. We've got a guy that was a first team all met 2 years in a row, Friendly High School, a standout at Providence College from 90 to 94, the 21st pick overall in the 1994 NBA draft, Chicago Bulls. He was a two-time NBA champion, and boy, he wears so many hats when it comes to the great game of hoops, basketball analyst, ESPN, scout, and he is the founder of Next Level Performance, Inc. He is Dickie Simpkins. Dickie, welcome to In and Out of Sports in the Coach's Corner. My man, how are you?
I'm doing good, Coach. Appreciate you having me on. And that intro you just gave right there was amazing. That's one of the all-time best intros I've had in a while. And I like that music coming in, blow the whistle. And I just got to make one correction on you, though, Coach. I got three NBA championship rings.
Oh, three. You know what? That is a big correction. Excuse me. And I know how you NBA guys with the rings are. I had the opportunity once, Dickie, to do a camp with the great Sam Jones. And one of the young guys at the camp, one of the campers said, "Are you better than Michael Jordan?" Sam looked at him and said, "How many rings does MJ have?" And the young man said, "Six." Sam said, "Well, I got 10. Man, it's great to have you aboard. But let's start off talking about what's going on now in the NBA. They're talking about, and I think that they're serious, and we're going to witness a restart by the league. And I've said this. Now, I know that there are some players who have opted out for various health concerns, and I understand that, and I support that 100%, and I think the league does as well. But, Dickie, I've said this now. During this pandemic, if you're in the NBA in Orlando, Florida, in that bubble, that may be the safest place to be. Because here it is, and I want to get your thoughts. The league will house 22 teams plus support staff at three different resorts. You'll have seven practice courts and playing games at three arenas. It is also providing meals, daily testing, other medical support, security transportation, and entertainment for over 1,500 people. Sounds like a pretty safe place to be, if any place to be is safe. Your thoughts, Dickie?
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. With the climate that we're in, with the pandemic, COVID-19, obviously it's been very challenging across the country as well as the world. So we know that a lot of lives have been lost, but I would have to say that the NBA, Adam Silver, have always been ahead of the game, have always been forward-thinking, have always kind of set the tone. I mean, when this whole – I remember being in Kansas City getting ready to scout the Big 12 tournament, and that was the right before the tournament. The night before was when Adam Silver and the NBA – postpone the season, shut the games down. So they set the tone, and everybody else, all the other sports leagues and colleges and everything kind of played off of the NBA setting that standard, setting that tone, and jumping out in front of things, forward thinking. So to answer your question, I believe that if anybody can do it, if anybody has the thought process and the proper plan, it's going to be the NBA, it's going to be Adam Silver, and going into the bubble, as you say, is probably more safe. You'll probably be more safe being in that airtight bubble with all the security, with all the plans, with everything that they have put together and proposed and agreed on, that you will probably have the lowest percentages and chances of catching the COVID-19. Now, we know that it's possible that it could happen, but if any place, like you said, the bubble, I would think, might be the safest place, even though it's in Orlando and in Florida where the count is going up, the COVID numbers are going up, I think the bubble will be safe.
Yeah, because they're going to be testing on a regular basis, and they'll have other medical staff there. So it's going to be a pretty safe environment, and in terms of how far, how much safe can be during this pandemic. Also, there's a lot of money at stake, a lot of money. Now, the NBA, it's being reported, Dickie, that they're spending $150 million just on the bubble alone, and then, you know, with the expenses. But they're saying now that they want to get the 80-plus regular season games in, plus four rounds of playoffs, so the league can pretty much protect itself from even more extended losses. Because they're going to lose probably $1 billion simply because there are no gate revenues. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, it's no mystery that money motivates a lot of situations. You're talking about
that's right,
over, you know, a $1 billion business. You're talking about teams evaluated at over $1 billion. You're talking about a lot of money being lost if the season is not able to continue. I mean, that's no mystery, as well as players who have made a very nice living off of making it to the NBA and playing. So, I mean, it's like out here in the real world, or in the world, in the country, as far as the government trying to move the economy back based on money. So you're battling with the money part, and you're battling with the health part. Everybody having the best interests of the country and having the best interests of the NBA players as far as their health, and trying to find that balance so you can at least try to maintain or recover financially, as, you know, as people in the work field, the people in the NBA, and a lot of jobs. So it is definitely a big piece of motivation from the financial standpoint, but I know that, again, Adam Silver and the NBA and the Players Association have done an excellent job of keeping in mind that health is first, and trying to find that balance where health, the priority of health can meet the priority of the finances, and I think they've done an excellent job. But you know, you're talking about a lot of money being lost, not just for the NBA, not just for the owners, for the players. And, you know, this could, if the season doesn't go on, or if something happens where it wouldn't go on, it could jeopardize, obviously, a lot of finances, and it could jeopardize the future of the NBA for the next couple of years and trying to recover from the loss of the finances. So the financial part is a big piece, just like it is out here in the country with everybody in unemployment looking for jobs. It's just the fact of trying to find that balance of keeping the priority of everybody's health first, and bringing in, finding a balance to bring the finance to meet the priority of the health. And I think the NBA is doing it. But the money part is a big situation, Coach. You talk about $150 million spent to make this happen. You're talking about $1 billion being lost. That's a lot of coins. That's a lot of coins right there. But the health is the most important thing. And I know that the players have the option of going down and starting with the restart or not, you know. And then everybody's risk level, risk mentality is going to be different. But I think the plan that's been put together from a health standpoint and a financial standpoint has been thoroughly and properly thought out.
Well said, man. Well said. And I like how you phrased the balance, in the balance of first health, but also finances. And I concur. Do you foresee any big names? Now, we've had some guys who are pretty good players opt out. But to my knowledge, Dickie, not a big, big name. Do you foresee any of the big names saying, I think I'll stay home?
It's still time before teams start heading out next week. I know that with our Washington Wizards organization, I know that it was reported today that Bradley Beal was still undecided. You know, I work for the Washington Wizards. I feel like Bradley Beal is a big name. It's not a done deal or a final decision on him not participating. But I know sports media reported today that he was undecided and that he wanted to, you know, have a conversation more with the organization and the trainers. But he's been working out in preparation to go back to the restart. So if he was to opt out of not going, that would be a very big name to not participate. Obviously, that would be a big loss for us as the Washington Wizards in competing in this restart, because the restart is kind of set up, and I was joking the other day, of like an NBA AAU tournament. Everybody's getting a guaranteed 8 games, and you got to make it happen to get to that next round, and we're in that kind of position as the Washington Wizards. But I do understand if guys are choosing not to go down to the restart for health reasons or just concerns, or they're just not sure. I get it, and I understand that whether big names, superstar names, or, you know, not superstar names. But it's still time, and there is a possibility that some big names could opt to not go. As of right now, I don't see the big names, star names, not going, unless they're guys that are already injured trying to rehab, like John Wall, Kevin Durant, Kyrie. If they're guys that's trying to rehab, obviously they're not going down. But as of right now, all signs point to the big superstar names are going to participate in the restart.
Dickie Simpkins, if you were a player, let's say if this were in the 90s and you're playing, which direction would you take? Would you opt to go? Would you have some concerns and say, no, I think I'm going to take the high road?
Well, I think right off the bat, as just a competitor and a basketball player, my mind would be leaning to go right off the bat. Like when they say we're going to try to start this thing back up, the first thing I would say is I'm going as a competitor and a basketball player, right? I want to get back to playing. Then after I got past that first initial thought, then I would reel it in and analyze my situation. So, you know, if it's me without a family and it's just me, then my tolerance for risk, my mentality for risk would be real high, you know. If it was me with my family like I have now, then I would have to take it to a whole nother level of really analyzing it on whether I would go or not. I would also have to look at my, you know, situation financially. Am I first year in the league? Do I have guaranteed money? Am I trying to play for a contract? You know, I would have to analyze those situations also. At the end of the day, after I would step back from my initial thought of a player just wanting to go and compete, and after I'd analyze everything, I would say that it would be a 97% to 98% chance that I would go down to the bubble for the restart. I think the 3% to 2% chance of me not going would be based on the health of my family, if there were any pre-existing situations with any of my family or if there were any pre-existing situations with myself, then that 2-3% of me not going would be in that range. Or I would just have to just go down and they wouldn't have to come. But at the end of the day, I think 97-98% I would go down for the restart and continue to play, do what needs to be done to continue to make sure the league keeps pushing forward, and go down and take advantage of the opportunity to showcase and use the platform for the climate that we're in with the social movement that we have going on. So those things would have pushed me to make that trip down. And then I would have said to myself, if I go down, it's a major sacrifice that I have to make and stick with for the better of myself, for the better of the NBA, for the better of my team, and for the better of the social movement. I would keep all those things in my mind for the sacrifice. Because at the end of the day, Coach, when they go in that bubble, it's going to be all about everybody's individual mindset towards the sacrifice it takes to really stay in that bubble. So to answer your question, I would have 97-98% would have went down for the restart.
Wow. I tell you, folks, this is going to be an outstanding one-on-one, very knowledgeable young man. He's done a lot in terms of basketball, and he is Dickie Simpkins. And, Dickie, you're from the DMV. Talk about how you initially started playing a game of basketball. And were you a phenom or were you a late bloomer? And I've always said, you at 6'8 or 6'9, I've always said that if you are a big player, I believed as a coach, it's advantageous to be a late bloomer versus a middle school phenom. Now, if you're a guard, you got to come out of the cradle dribbling and passing no looks. But as a big man, hey, you know what? 9th grade, 10th grade, you can develop. But talk about your origin of playing the game, and when did you start to really grow and develop into the player that you became?
Well, the first thing is what you just said about the development later being a big factor for big men or taller players. I've always thought that that was a big key for everybody, whether you're a guard, forward, or big. I agree with you that you want to get a feel and start dribbling the ball early and start getting a feel for the game at a young age. But in my AAU program, I always try to tell the parents, don't get caught into kids that are super advanced in elementary school and middle school, because I've seen this movie before many a times. When I played as a young kid, when I played in high school, when I played in college, when I played, and then when I started my program, I've seen this movie many times. Kids start off so advanced, and very few of them maintain that advanced level as they start getting to middle school and high school, and other kids start catching up and surpass them from a skill set. So I see it all the time, and I try to taper parents' expectations, because everybody wants to be at a high level right out of the crib, right? And I get that. But for me, I started playing basketball when my older brother, put a basketball in my hand around 3rd grade, 4th grade, and the first thing he taught me was to be as versatile as possible, know how to do everything. Know the game, learn the game, and know how to do a little bit of everything on the court. So he was the first one to start me off with that when that wasn't being taught to tall kids. Back in the day, if you were tall, play in the post. So I was kind of, from a mentality, ahead of that process. And one of my guys, you had him on the show, Kurt Smith, always messed with me. He always called me the first stretch four out there. So he always jokes with me about that. But the ball was stuck in my hand by my brother. I kind of had some natural talent, instinct, and abilities. And I remember one day in the 4th grade, a kid in my class said, we had gym class, we were playing basketball, and he came to me and he said, Hey, my dad's coaching the basketball team down at the Park District or Fort Washington Rec. So I said, he said, come on down. Why don't you come to the game this Saturday and play? So I went home, asked my mother. My mother was kind of like, I don't know. And then I just kept on asking. And she said, go ahead. So I walked on down to Potomac Landing, showed up. His dad gave me a jersey. I went out there, played the whole game, had the ball, dribbled up and down the court, scored a lot of points, and then went from there.
Wow.
So that was kind of the origin of where it started. And then what happened was, because I was tall, I went to playing county basketball in the rec. Mm-hmm. And I was always playing with older kids, a year older. And at that time, I wasn't ready to play with older kids, but and it was kind of daddy ball. I was playing daddy ball back then. You know, the teams I played on, they were coached by their fathers.
Mm-hmm.
And their father's agenda was to develop their son. And so because I was young and because I came from a single-parent home living with my mother, I didn't have a father around to kind of speak up for me, kind of evaluate the situation, kind of analyze and make sure that I was properly getting developed. I kind of just had to figure it out on my own, find my way. And you know, in one sense, it helped because it helped me develop the ability to evaluate my environment, evaluate who is true to really developing me and trying to bring me along. So it helped me grow fast. But then after that, that was probably sixth, seventh grade. When those guys went off to high school, I got to play eighth grade basketball, and I had a coach by the name of Jerome County. He was a very good player, played at Friendly High School, and he coached the team. And he came to me and he said, look, man, I'm going to help you, you know, grow to the next level. And he was the first person that really took an interest in really developing me, building my confidence, and letting me do things on the court, trial and error, and just always having the confidence. And then I turned into the guy that was the main guy on the team. And my development accelerated that eighth grade year. And so he was kind of a big piece. And then he took me to Roy Henderson. After my eighth grade year, that summer before high school, he took me to Roy Henderson. He said, hey, this kid's going to go to Friendly, and he's got a chance. And Roy Henderson trusted him. Roy Henderson put me on the summer league team. I wasn't even in high school yet, and we were playing up at Central High School. I think that summer league was at Central High School. It was the big summer league in PG County. And I was playing against guys like Byron Tucker at Potomac, Mike Tate, you know, you name it, Henry Hall. It was just, the Crossland, them Crossland boys, Clarence Alford, Walt Williams.
Yeah.
I was going to the ninth grade. And so that was an eye opener. And then my high school coach, Roy Henderson, he had a plan for me. And then it took off from there. And I would say that my freshman year, I started off on JV. He moved me up to varsity. I didn't want to go to varsity because I was killing on JV, so I didn't want to go. But he had a plan for me when he moved me up. I was always practicing with the varsity. And it kind of went from there, and I would say I played AAU, and that summer after ninth grade is kind of where it took off. And I guess you can say I turned into a – I don't know if you want to call it a high school phenom, but I turned into a very high-level high school recruit and a very high-level talented player in the DMV from there. And then it went from there.
Coach Henderson, wasn't he a coach at Bladensburg before he got to Friendly?
Yeah, he coached Thoroughbilly. He coached Thoroughbilly
That's
at
right,
Bladensburg.
Yeah.
He coached John Smith at Friendly, John Smith that went to Duke. So I was fortunate enough to go to a high school with a coach who had already coached high-level talent.
Yep.
He kind of had a system, but his system wasn't to the point where it wasn't more about his system when he had players who had talent. He knew how to groom and develop and allow you as a talented player to expand your talent within his system. He wasn't like, you know, just trying to keep you conformed or keep you in a box. And ultimately, he had a plan for me because I remember – I got invited to Nike camp, And it was my sophomore year. I got invited to Nike camp, and I came. He called me in his office. He was like, "Hey, I got this letter for you to go to this prestigious camp. Only the top 100 players in the country going there." And I was like, "Coach, I don't want to go there. I want to be here this summer and just hang out and play ball around here." Coach Henderson said, "No, you're going to this camp." And when I went to that camp, that was an eye-opener for me as far as the talent level around the country. I had kind of seen it the summer. But I remember going to Union Station, getting on the train, and that's when I first met my boy Kurt Smith.
Oh, yeah.
That's when I met Donald Ford. That's when we all kind of met each other. And it was the coming together of the talent, the upcoming talent in the DMV. And it was a great experience just to be around those guys and see that level of talent and all of us representing the DMV up at Nike Camp, where we stood out amongst the best players in the country.
Yeah, and I was disappointed. Now, this is Coach McAdams speaking. I was disappointed that you weren't mentioned in the documentary PG Basketball County in the Water. And I understand the young men did a great job, and I understand that Kevin Durant and his people had to chop it up. But from a historic standpoint, as I've said, PG County basketball, the dominance didn't start 20 years ago. It didn't start in the year 2000. It started long before then. And then when you talk about Prince George's County, you got to talk about people like, you know, Ducey Smith of Fairmont Heights, Harold Fox of Northwestern, you know, a Fatty Taylor, a Chicken Breast. Those were the pioneers, and then it evolved to a Dickie Simpkins, a Thurl Bailey, and Adrian Branch. I mean, I could go on and on of folks who weren't mentioned. I understand it's less than an hour. It's hard to get everything and everyone in an hour. But if you're going to do something on history, you got to do it right. And that's how I see it. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I'll say is the fact that PG County basketball was able to get a platform to be highlighted, obviously, by Kevin Durant, which was a big part of helping to highlight PG County basketball. I have to say that was big. That was big for PG County to see that to see the county on Showtime, primetime TV. So that was a big achievement, big accomplishment, and big ups to Kevin Durant and his production company and the team that he had to put that together. But even that being said, I thought the show was produced in high quality. Obviously, I wouldn't expect anything less. And I heard all the behind-the-scenes rumblings of a lot of guys not mentioned in that documentary. I heard the rumblings of D.C. versus Maryland and Virginia. And so, you know,
Which is ridiculous. You know what? Go ahead, Dickie.
No. My take is, if you played in PG County, you had to come through D.C., you had to come through Virginia, you had to play against the best of the best through that area in order to get stamped. That was just it. If you didn't play against guys from D.C., Virginia, Maryland, if you all didn't come across each other to be the best of the best, you wasn't going to get stamped, or you were going to get, or they were going to say you ducking the wreck. You know, you always ducking the wreck. You know that terminology of ducking the wreck. And as I was growing up, I never wanted to be one of those dudes that was ducking the wreck. I was always ready. If somebody said come play in the outside in D.C., I remember getting asked to Doc. I remember Doc coming up and getting me when I was in the ninth grade to go play at Doc's gym. I never ducked the wreck. But in saying all that, I would have tried to find – I understand it was an hour-long documentary. I would have tried to find a 10-minute segment in that documentary, 5 to 10 minutes or 10 minutes, and try to do a fast-forward from back in the day up to 2000 segment of chronological order of guys that are the pioneers, like you said, the OGs of PG County. Because one thing I know is I always give respect to the OGs of and the pioneers of the NBA, because I wouldn't have been able to be in the NBA. So when I see the pioneers, I make my way over there, shake their hand, and acknowledge them as the OGs of the NBA and the pioneers, as I would do for the pioneers of PG, as I would do for the pioneers of the DMV area, period. So I would try to find a 10-minute segment in there to at least, you know, give you a little documentary fast forward of a chronological order of, like, the names you named, the Thurl Bailey, the Adrian Branches, the Monty Williams, you know, the Henry Halls.
Oh, yeah.
The guys that you named.
Penny Green, Archie Talley.
Yes. The pioneers, the OGs, that because PG County started way before 2000. PG County started way before my era of 87, 86 to 90. And so I would have tried to find a way. But at the end of the day, you know, everybody's not going to be able to be in something, and I get that. But I would have tried to find a way. I think the project was very good, and it was just great to see PG County. And I walked away taking it that the focus was on Kevin Durant and the guys that he came up with in the 2000 decade. That's what I walked away with, that focus. But that's how I would have did it. So, I mean, I have no ill will about not being mentioned in it, you know, being a – You know, I mean, my resume, at the end of the day for me, people ask me about it. I say, hey, man, my resume speaks for itself. For a fact that I was stamped when I was in the DMV playing basketball. Nobody could take that away, and it's all good.
Mm-hmm. Being all good, let's talk about that 1989 All-Met team. And we had a conversation before the show, and, man, what you said – I can't disagree. It's certainly a great debate. But 1989, the Washington metropolitan area All-Met team, out of the 10 players, how many played professional ball?
It was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 out of the 10 were drafted in the NBA. 6 out of the 10 were drafted in the NBA, but all 10 players, I mean, you're talking about George Lynch, Mike Smith, Monty Williams, Lawrence Moten, Aaron Bain, Mike Tate, Grant Hill, Ray Slater. People don't remember Ray Slater that played out at Laurel. She was a wingman who could shoot the ball and was super athletic. And then, of course, I can't forget the talented one of the guys that I saw early doing all the stuff with the ball in his hands and making plays. And he and I was roommates at Nike Camp when we first met. You can't forget about my man, Kurt Smith. So,
we can't forget about Trouble. And I'm going to tell you somebody else that won't forget about him. And that's Kenny Anderson. Kenny Anderson won't forget about Kurt either.
No. He won't. He definitely won't. Forget about Kurt. And then, I mean, Kurt and I had played together. We had met going to Nike camp, spent time, became boys. We played in Boston Shootout together. With Kurt was killing in the Boston Shootout. Guys,
oh, man,
up there.
Tremendous play.
And then, you know, and then every when I was in college, when I was in NBA, Kurt and or Smitty, his brother Charles, they would hit me up. They would hit me up. I knew I would get a call from them. They would hit me up. They'd be, look, you in town? We need you in town. We need you to come up and play with us at the Herbo. And all it takes for them to call me, and I'm there. They call me, I'm there,
right,
showing up at the Herbo to play. But that 10 players with Coach McGlees from Dunbar, I mean.
Yeah, good
that's,
man.
That, I mean, I've heard a lot of people debate on – that being one of the all-time All-Met teams, and I know you and I were talking about that OG team of 76, right? That was a mob squad of some OGs back then. But I was able to That team, man, I look at that picture all the time. Grant will send me the picture. He sent me the picture one time. It was definitely a very talented team.
Well, I was just so blessed to be a coach during that era and competing, you know, against some of those great players and seeing some of those great players. And I can attest that that was a great era, and you certainly can make an argument that that 1989 All-Met team was simply one of the best. Now, you are not just an All-Met, but you're an All-American. You are a parade All-American. You've got a number of schools pursuing you. You select Providence. Talk about how that came about.
Yeah, so I was fortunate enough to have every school in the country recruit me. It was amazing. And it's funny, my mother wanted me to go to Notre Dame. She just wanted me to go to Notre Dame. She wanted me to go to Notre Dame because of the prestige academically, you know. So Mike Bray was coming. Mike Bray, Coach K, were coming to see me, wanted me to go to Duke. Phil Ford, Dean Smith, Phil Ford was coming over to Friendly, wanted me to go to North Carolina. All the Big East schools would recruit me. So I was a kind of a different breed, I guess you would say. I kind of had a certain chip on my shoulder that I wanted to go somewhere and kind of make my own name. I always wanted to play in the Big East or the ACC. That I knew. I was going to play in the Big East or the ACC because that's what I just grew up watching. And I wanted to make a name for myself. I had a chip on my shoulder to play against any guy that was supposed to be as good or better or talked about. So everybody was kind of going to Duke at the time. You know, Grant had committed to Duke. Kenny Blakeney had committed to Duke. Christian Ash had committed to Duke. He played at High Point, the German kid that played at High Point. And then a couple other guys that committed to Duke that I had come across during Nike camp and things of that nature. And I was like, yeah, I'm not going to go where everybody else is going. My priorities and my decision were to go somewhere away from home, to go somewhere where I had a high chance to play right away or start or play starter minutes as a freshman, and to play on TV and a place where they were starting to build a tradition. And so I narrowed my schools down to visits to Notre Dame, UConn, Providence, Maryland. And I went down to James Madison because I always wanted to play for Lefty Gizell. And his son, Chuck Gizell, talked me into coming down to visit. I always wanted to play for Lefty.
Yeah.
But I wanted to play for Lefty. I wanted to play for Lefty at Maryland, not James Madison. But I went to take a visit just to make sure.
Sure.
Just to make sure, see if it would be a spot. And then my first visit was Notre Dame. And I remember coming back from Notre Dame, and I just told my mother. That was my first visit, so she was just hoping that would be the place. And I remember coming back, because back then it wasn't like now. You go on visits as a kid, and you pretty much had to figure this out on your own. You know, your parents weren't traveling with you,
right?
Going with you like they have it now. So I just came back and told my mother, yeah, I won't be going to Notre Dame. It's just I don't feel the vibe there. I don't feel outside of campus. There's nothing really to do, and I just didn't feel like it was a place for me. And Monty was there. Monty and I had a good friendship. We have a good friendship. And Monty was one of the big pieces that I said it would be the piece that would kind of help me lean to going there, but it just wasn't my place. So basically, it came down to basically UConn and Providence. Calhoun had just got UConn rolling, and I went to visit UConn, and I was like, yeah, I'm going to go to UConn. And then I went on my visit to Providence. And it was just something about the family atmosphere and the vibe with the players that I felt like it was a family. And they had just won went to the Final Four with Rick Pitino. Rick Barnes had just got there. He was in his second year coaching at Providence. They were in the tournament. They were building something there. And I felt like I could come in and play right away or start. I was in the Big East playing on TV. And it was away from home, and it was a school that I didn't have to compete with football or any other sport. We were basically the NBA or the Providence, played in the big arena downtown. And I wanted to grow up and be away from home, and that's what my decision came down to.
Wow, and boy, what a decision. And you guys had a really good team, and I took a lot of pride in watching you guys because of you and, of course, Michael Smith. And that was a tremendous 1-2 punch. Now, who was the power forward? Who was the center? And how did the two of you guys work out? Sometimes you have twin towers, so to speak, two really talented front court players, and they can't play together. And then other times they can play together, and when that happens, boy, the opposition has trouble on their hands. You guys play well together. But talk about that tandem and how you guys had the great chemistry.
Well, yeah, it definitely worked out. Mike Smith is a brother. That's a brother to me. Mike Smith is my brother. We spent a lot of time battling. And it worked out, one, because, you know, I was kind of the glue that put all of us together and kept it together, and kind of Coach Barnes kind of relied on me with my basketball IQ, feel, and ability and versatility. So that was what kind of helped Mike and I be able to play together. And then we had the talented Eric Williams with us also. So
yes.
What happened was we weren't really a center and a forward or anything. We were just like a versatile unit. Most of the time, Mike would guard the forwards. Eric Williams would guard a forward, and then Coach Barnes would have me guard whoever was the main scorer on the other team. So it could have been from a center to a forward to a guard. So it worked because of my ability to facilitate as a versatile big, play on the outside, play on the inside, and guard different positions, which gave Mike the ability to play inside and rebound the ball like he did, like a monster, and rebound and get the ball down low and score. And then we played in transition a lot at Providence, so we just got out and ran. But it gave Mike Smith the ability to kind of have his way down low, because I could play inside and outside. And it gave Eric Williams was very good from the elbow areas and posting and footwork in the mid-post. And so it gave him space to operate also. So it worked out, but I think a lot of it was just Coach Barnes relying on my mentality, my abilities to see the game, versatility, basketball IQ, and just knowing everybody's position and the roles and being a leader of the team. And we ended up all having a common goal of just winning the Big East, and that's how it worked out.
Before the show, we were talking, as we do, and my producer, Rick Hampton Sr., had asked a question about, you know, how do you feel about the way the game is being played today in terms of what's allowed and what's not. And then I jumped in and said, man, the Big East. See, I was a Big East guy. I wasn't an ACC guy, because as a coach, I don't want the finesse guy. I want the meat and potatoes guy that will go and get the rebound and knock 2-3 players down while getting it, okay? And that's why I enjoyed the Big East, because, you know what, no blood, no foul at the Big East. Talk about the style of playing the Big East, and talk about some of those heated rivals and rivalries, teams and players that you encountered.
Yeah, I mean, the Big East was absolutely one of the most physical conferences in college basketball. Me watching it before I got there with the Patrick Ewings and the Michael Grahams. I mean, Michael Graham, I used to always joke, like, Michael Graham is like the most – I tell people all the time, they start talking about Big East players, and I'm like, Michael Graham, they're like, who's Michael Graham? And I always say, he's the most OG, most toughest college basketball player that I've ever seen in my life, that was about no games. An enforcer, the meaning of an enforcer.
That's
physicality.
Right.
And so I saw the physicality of the Big East. And then when I got there, I played against the Alonzo Mournings, the Dikembe Mutombos, the you know, the Conrad McCrae at Syracuse and Brian Shorter at Pittsburgh. So it was physical. It was no doubt the physicality. The Big East was physical. It was no – couldn't come in there, you know, with the finesse or not ready for the physicality. But like anything, like we were talking before we came on the air, like anything, I think the biggest thing is that you have to, you know, be open, be willing for the evolution of the game, the evolution of anything, right? And sometimes the guys from back in the day, the pioneers, the guys that played with the physicality, it's tough to kind of embrace the new generation, the new style, the new finesse, the new mobility of the game and open area and space and shooting. And so today's game, you know, it's cool. I mean, it enhances the offensive part of the game. It enhances and shows the development of skill, you know, more. And, you know, I think it's still – I always try to go about it as I think it's still a place for the game to have the element of the physicality part and blend it with the element of the finesse and the shooting and the skill. I think it's still – can be blended together. Obviously, the game has changed where it's a more open court, open space, but I still think it's a place for some of the old school physicality, toughness, rough part of the game that can blend in with new. So I'm cool. I understand the new style, the new generation, and I've always been from a grassroots coach to just developing kids. Hey, the kids of the day, they want to know how you're going to help them get to the NBA, how you're going to help them enhance their game. And they always want to do the stuff that they can't do right now and not be able to stay locked in on the stuff they can and grow from there. So the kids of the day are funny, man. They want to see you be able to help them get to the NBA, help them do all these different things in the game. But you have to be able to be open to let them know, I'm going to help you get there, but here's some core stuff you have to do, and let's understand what your bread and butter is right now, and we'll grow from that and show them how they can be a valued player with that, with still the opportunity to grow and make money at this game. Because when I came up, my brother gave me the ball, and he said, be versatile. And my whole time starting off, people just wanted me to be a post player. And I was cool with that, but I knew I had other skills. And then once I got to high school, those skills were allowed to show more and more. And when I got to college, it's funny, Coach Barnes, we would get trapped doing playing against teams, and Coach Barnes would just be like, yo, get the ball to Dick. Think he's going to take it out, give it back to him, and he'll bring it down court. Because at that time, the guy guarding me was not used to guarding a big guy who could handle the ball and bring it down
court.
Right. So
yeah.
To answer your question, I'm cool where the game has gone. I'm cool with how it's played. I understand it. I think it's brought fun to watch an offense. But I still think it's you can blend old school with the new generation and new school and still get it done.
Dickie Simpkins is in the coach's corner. And, Dickie, I agree with you, but now – call me old school, but I got to say it. The one thing I cannot wrap my hands around and evolve to, and I can't watch it. And you know what that is? The NBA All-Star Game. I have not watched the NBA All-Star Game in about 3 years. I refuse to watch it because it's not basketball. Before this pandemic, you talk about social distancing. That's what they did on defense. It was literally no defense. And I understand it's an exhibition. I understand nobody wants to get hurt. But still, where are the competitive juices, man? I can't watch it, Dickie. I'm sorry. Cannot watch it.
I agree with you. I mean, if there was one thing that I'm very disappointed in with today's basketball versus back in the day is the level of competitiveness. I think that has diminished tremendously in basketball now because everybody's path is trying to be custom and catered to. And kids are not having the ability to deal with adversity. And so if you don't deal with adversity and challenges in your journey, that's a high chance of losing your competitiveness, because you're going to always feel like when you come up against a wall of competition, you're going to always feel like, hey, I don't need to compete. I know my route is being custom made or catered to the right way for me to get to the goal. And so that's the part that I'm disappointed about, and it transcends all the way up to the NBA. I mean, I see kids at grassroots. I see kids in college doing my TV games for Fox Sports. I see kids when I scout college games as potential draft picks. And I am disappointed in the level of competitiveness and mental toughness in competing.
Why is that?
Because kids are brought up now to not play competitively outside, to not only go play in an environment that is definitely catered for them to be the standout or to succeed, be on this certain team because you're going to be this or be the man or be the point guard, be at this gym because you're going to be the best player in this gym. Everything is catered. Everybody has seen some type of kid before them being recruited or YouTube, and they're trying to cater and custom their path. Where when I came up, it was you either go to Doc's gym, and when you walk in that door, you got one chance to go in there and be tough and show you can compete against the Michael Grahams, the James Donaldsons, the Patrick Ewings, anybody in Doc's gym. And if you don't go in there and compete, you won't be coming back to that gym. And today, kids, parents, whoever's in their circle of directing their basketball, they try to avoid or try to cater or custom their process, their journey, and you just can't do that. And you miss on the element of surprise, the element of competitive surprise. When you walk in the gym, you don't know who's in there. You've never seen these guys before, and they are monsters, and they compete. They're good as you or even better. Let's see how you operate in the lion's den. Most of the time I'm seeing the kids and parents and the developers are trying to avoid those situations or trying to make sure it is perfect for them to succeed. And it's okay for you to fail at adversity so you can see what you're made of and build a mental toughness and a competitive toughness. I would say those are the main factors why that has diminished in today's basketball generation, which has affected, you know, the All-Star game of what you've seen and what makes the All-Star game more of, you know, just a showcase. But I will say this past All-Star game was the most competitive that I had seen in a while because they changed some of the rules to try to make it competitive, and it seemed like the guys took some pride and let's put on a show of competition. And so that is the part that I'm disappointed in, and everybody wants to play with their friends instead of play against their friends and bust their friends in the head. And it boils down to this last piece that I'll say. It boils down to this, and this is the final piece and why it's like it is, the question that you asked me. More basketball players today want to be liked than be respected. They want to be liked than be respected. And there is no in between. You can't straddle the fence. You got to make a decision. Do you want to be respected or do you want to be liked? If you want to be respected, you're going to be that guy that's going to compete and go against anybody and have a chip on your shoulder against your friends, against anybody. And then when you get off that court, you can still be cool with your friends. If you want to be liked, then you don't want to ruffle anybody's feathers, you don't want to be making any mistakes, and you don't want to mess up your friendship, and you want to make sure all the fans like you. The one thing of playing with Michael Jordan and him being a leader of that Chicago Bulls team through them three championships, it was no question, Michael Jordan, he's going to gain respect. He's going into this about being respected. He doesn't care anything about you liking him or not. If you want to win, you're going to respect how he goes about it, and respect him as a leader. And that is the final piece of why the competitive toughness, mental toughness, competitive level has diminished in now today's generation of basketball.
That's a perfect segue. Let's talk about your experience with the Bulls, winning three championships, and especially playing with Michael Jordan. We all, most of us, witnessed the wonderful documentary ESPN, The Last Dance. Did that give an accurate depiction of the competitiveness and the continuous will to excel by Michael Jordan?
I enjoy watching The Last Dance, and every piece that I was involved with, from the time MJ came back, that was my rookie season, all the way to the last championship in 98 that they showed that we won. My time with MJ, everything that was depicted in that documentary from the time I was there was pretty accurate, was very accurate. The parts before I got there, I can't vouch for how accurate that was. I would assume it was, but obviously we've seen since The Last Dance, it's been a lot of rumbling of what was true or what was not true. So I'm not going to get into that. That's a lot of goofball stuff. All I know is I get everybody wants to have that say what's true, but the part that I was involved with from 94 to 98 with MJ, obviously I played two more years after we won the last championship, that was accurate. And like I said, you know, when I deal with my program, AAU program, I tell kids off the bat, make a decision before you start playing here on whether you want to be respected or you want to be liked. And that's going to kind of dictate your path. Well, when MJ came back that December and started practicing with us, everything that I had heard about MJ, when I saw it with my own eyes in practice and in games, it was real. And it was all about a level of competitiveness that the only thing out there and on his mind is about winning. By any means, any cost, and you're going to respect the way he goes about it. And if you don't respect the way he goes about it, you don't like it, and you're not ready to be at that level, with whatever your role is, obviously there's only one MJ, but he expected you to be on the level he was to perform at the highest level of your role, whatever that role was. And if you wasn't with that, you wasn't about winning. And that was just the way it is. And again, you know, I was able to win in the Big East. I was able to win in the NBA. And like, again, I try to get that to the kids that I coach. And I say, at the end of the day, there's no fake hustle out here, man. People are going to be able to see you for who you are if you're trying to fake hustle. And if you're not trying to win, it's going to come out. And the bottom line is, we win as a team, you're going to win as an individual. If you try to win as an individual, we're not going to win as a team. And that pretty much comes across to the guys in my program. And we've been able to win two national championships in AAU with my program. I've been able to have some NBA guys. But at the end of the day, yes, the stuff was accurate in The Last Dance from the part I was there with MJ.
Radio is theater of the mind. Can you share with us two memorable stories as it pertains to Michael Jordan, whether it's a game or practice?
I will say one story or one situation is practice. MJ practiced every day. There was no load management. There was no taking a day off. He could have had back-to-back nights of double nickels, 55 points. He's coming in there to practice, and he's coming in there to talk trash like he does on the court in the games. He's coming in there and practice. And I don't think people really realize that the greatest player to ever play the game, the greatest player, the most popular player in the world, one of the most popular and recognizable figures in the world, practiced and worked every day. And when Phil really wanted to make practice even another level of competitiveness, he put Pip and MJ on different teams. And when I say respect versus being liked, Pip was obviously the piece of the dynamic duo, MJ and Scottie Pippen. But when they were on separate teams in practice, MJ was going at Pip's neck as if he was on another team. And that's just it. So that's one thing that stood out. That's one thing that stood out. And then I would say in a game, I would say that final game and that final game in game six in the finals against Utah. I just had a feeling. I just knew that MJ is going to come up with a play for us to win this game. He's going to make this happen. I just knew that. Just watching him all the time that I watch him, he's going to come. His mentality is he's going to come up with a play. Well, you know what? He came up with the last three big plays of the game. He came up with the drive, the quick drive to the basket, the finish, to put us down by one. We go down on defense. He comes up with the big steal from Karl Malone in the critical. And he goes down, and you watch that. Everybody knew to get out of the way. He's not about to give the ball to nobody. And you knew that he's going to take this last shot and live or die with it. And it's a 99.9% chance he's going to live with this as being a make for the game winner. And he made it with the exaggerated follow-through of the skill that people don't even realize. They talk about the shot, but just the exaggerated move, the instinct, what he's worked on practice, and the exaggerated follow-through with the confidence for a game winner is unbelievable. Those three plays. So I would say that pretty much sealed the deal for me of him, just everything that I saw and playing with him and being around him. And then the last thing I would say, MJ to be the most popular, the greatest player to ever play the game, to have that notoriety, the money, the all that fame, he handled it tremendously well for a human being. I don't think anybody in his place would have been able to handle that type of level of hype as he did. I don't think anybody would have been able to do that.
I've often said that I look at guys like Michael Jordan, LeBron, Derek Jeter. Those three come to mind in terms of notoriety and hype. And look, we're all human. We all have our flaws. But these guys understand who they are and what they represent. And you don't hear them going to the club, getting in a fight or you know, driving while drunk. No, you don't hear any of that. What makes them different from some of the other young, talented athletes? They get it. But why do they get it and some don't?
I believe that, and this is just seeing, I don't know Derek Jeter. I know MJ and I are friends, play together. I know MJ, I talked to him. I know LeBron. I've seen LeBron when he first came into the league, when he would come to Chicago before he got drafted and play with us in the summertime. I think these guys understood the long game. They understood the long game from a brand perspective, a financial perspective. They understood the long game from an image and branding perspective. And that was because of the people that they had around them and them seeing how they culturally and athletically changed the game in their perspective sports. And so I think those are the things that made them get it, the long game. And these guys, LeBron, MJ, Derek Jeter, definitely MJ and LeBron, they're gonna be talked about forever. They're gonna be in the long game financially forever, branding. And it's part of the people that are around them, it's part of their mentality and understanding. And that's why they get it. A lot of guys play the short game. A lot of guys are not, you know, it's like when I was in college, a lot of guys that I played against in high school, and then when they got to college, it got to be a level of more difficult, more adversity. and the sacrifice you have to make for the long game, everybody can't do, everybody can't fight through that. And I think these guys understood from a branding perspective and a financial perspective the long game.
And, you know, it's ironic that those three came to mind, and I'm thinking Michael Jordan, the only African-American majority owner of a major sports franchise in this country. Derek Jeter is the operating person who runs the baseball team in Miami. And I think if this is his desire, I really believe in another 10 years or 15 or so, when a franchise is up for sale, that LeBron James potentially could be the second majority owner. And again, it goes back to your explanation, which is excellent, understanding the long game.
Yeah, no, I love it. MJ obviously set the stage of changing the culture of the game and changing the game from a marketability and a financial state off the court as well as on the court. LeBron has taken it to a whole nother level. I'm talking about as a player, as you're still playing, not after you're playing. I'm talking about as he's still playing, he's taken it to a whole nother level. A whole nother level that is showing the next generation of players, the young players, of what is out there and capable for you to do from a business perspective in this game and utilizing this game that's been good to him. And you're right. I expect that one of LeBron's next business ventures will be to own an NBA team. And I wouldn't be surprised if he brought together several other players and they went and got a team and he was the majority owner, and it'd be an all former NBA players owned team. I'm expecting that to happen. But LeBron has taken what MJ has paved the way for all of us, and now he's taking it to another level as a player.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of taking it to another level, when I speak to young people and we talk about sports, Dickie, I always emphasize that, as you know, only a small percentage can make it to the professional ranks, the NBA and overseas. However, there's so many other avenues that you can exploit, so to speak, coaching. You can be a trainer. You can be an official. You can be a writer, on and on and on. I bring that up because you've done that. You've been a player, a scout, an analyst, a color commentator. Talk to us about the various hats that you wear as it pertains to basketball and how you prepare for those different jobs. Let's start with scouting first.
Well, it all comes from, like, what I said when I first started playing basketball, that versatility, right? The ability to do a bunch of different things. And then I have to thank my mother for teaching me from an educational standpoint and a cultural standpoint to be able to think out of the box and be able to have exposure to a lot of things and have the mentality to be open to have exposure and learn all these different things. So what happened was, I was coming down, winding down to my basketball career. I was playing in Germany at the time on a EuroLeague team. And I probably could have played 3 more years, but mentally I was kind of at the point where I was like, second guessing it, and my little kids were starting to grow up now and be like, you know, second, third grade, fourth grade. And so I came back home after playing in Germany. I sat at the table. I wrote down on a piece of paper all the different things that I was capable of doing, all the different things that I had done up until that point as an intern or sample or whatever. and all the things that I had major relationships in. And so we'll start off with Scout, but it kind of evolved. I had Scout on there, general manager, but it kind of evolved to Scout because of my relationship. I was driving to the University of Illinois to do a TV game for ESPN. My phone rings, and it's MJ and Rod Higgins on the phone calling me. And MJ wanted me to come down to the – they were the Bobcats at the time. And he wanted me to come on board and help them build and work to move up in the NBA ranks in the front office. And so, you know, MJ, like a brother to me, like a big brother, friend, was good to me, always been good to me. I mean, of course, my loyalty to MJ.
Derek, hold it right there. Stop right there, excuse me, just for a second, because I want to make a point. And I've said this, and people who are on the inside know. But I've said that Michael Jordan has gotten a bad rap through the years of Michael Jordan doesn't care about anybody. He doesn't fight for the causes. He doesn't do this. And my response has always been, Michael Jordan does a lot that people don't know. And the first thing that I noticed about MJ is when he got in real power in terms of ownership, boy, he hired a lot of people that were close with him, former teammates, and a lot of them looked like him. They were African American. I had to get that in. Now you can confirm that.
No, you're absolutely right. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, at the end of the day, my relationship, people always ask me, man, you and MJ friends. I said, well, how did that happen? I said, well, from what I understand and what I've seen and being around MJ, when he first came to the team and I was a rookie, he saw how hard I worked. He saw how I understood my role, and he understood how that I was going to come do my job. And if you did that, MJ was going to respect you. And if he respect you, you were going to be a part of what he was trying to do, winning. And so we developed a relationship based on him respecting my work ethic and how I approach things and as a young guy. So MJ calls me, he wants me to come down and join. And it was like, and I just, my answer was just tell me when and where to be. And that's how I got started in scouting. I was scouting for the Bobcats, then we turned to the Hornets, and I was there for scouting there for 8 seasons. And then I came over to the Wizards. So I'm in my second season with the Wizards. But I prepared for my job just by knowing the players coming up, having an understanding of who the players, going out traveling, watching guys play, doing intel on guys, watching film, and using my experience, my feel, my knowledge, and the tools available with analytics that we get provided and film and everything to do my job and evaluate players as a scout and understanding what's a fit, how we play, and what we need. So that's kind of how I do my job in scouting. And it's the same thing with TV. Because all of the things I do kind of play off of each other. So I kind of know these players, see these players, but I prepare 3 or 4 days before a game, knowing the players, knowing the teams, understanding what the style of the game is going to be, knowing the coaches, kind of understanding who I'm working with. And I go in with my flavor and my abilities. I did radio. When I was at Providence, I worked on the radio station. I was disc jockey on the radio station. So, you know, I kind of just parlayed that into TV. And again, my TV opportunity came because of a relationship. Doris Burke is a Providence College alum, and Doris's former husband was our sports information director. He was our SID when I played, and I knew Doris when she first got into TV. So when I got ready to finish playing basketball, I called her husband, said, I want to get in TV. He said, call Doris. I called Doris, and Doris turned me on to the person that I needed to communicate with directly. And then it gave me a door to show my skill set and build a connection to get my opportunity. So that's how I got into TV, and then with my basketball development program, NLP, Team NLP, I just felt like I was blessed with a gift of talent and abilities and exposure and being able to see the NBA in Europe and play internationally. And I wanted to give that gift to the young generation coming up and help them develop and show them the way. And I always tell my own son, I have the answers to the test, and only a dummy fails when he's got the answers. And so I try to get the answers to the test to my program, players in my program, and we've been doing it for 12 years, and it's been great. We've had NBA players. We've had guys in Europe. I mean, Brandon Paul, that played at Illinois, played at San Antonio. Javon Carter just got drafted a couple of years ago, plays for Phoenix Suns. Admiral Schofield, who's with the Wizards, played in my program. He's from Chicago. We've had a lot of guys playing in Europe, and guys, like you said, we have guys doing other things too, officiating in business. It's funny, the kids stay in contact with me. They're developing families now, having kids. And it's an ongoing, lifelong mentorship I have for these guys. So that's how I prepare, and that's how I do all my different jobs.
And what was, we got about 10 minutes or less remaining, but what was the origin of the Next Level Performance?
It started off as I was just going to train kids to help them in basketball, just do skill development. And I tried to figure out a name. And I was like, I want to take kids to the next level and take their performance to the next level. So that's kind of how it came with the Next Level Performance. And then I said NLP. And then what happened was I was training some kids, and then all of a sudden my parents said, man, you should start a team, AAU team. And I was like, nah, I don't want to do that, man. AAU, it's not like I used when I played. And so I kind of didn't want to do it. And then in the 11th hour, I said, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and do it because I'm going to show people how to do it the right way. And basically, we run our program like a college/NBA program. And I just try to show people how to do it the right way and help kids. And then that's what brought along Team NLP, the travel team part. And I started off one team. The next year, I had five teams. And then we got all the way up to like 12 teams. And so it became a big program in the Midwest.
Do you have an email or Instagram or Facebook where if people want to get in contact with you? I'm certain we've got a tremendous crowd. My producer's telling me that we have a tremendous crowd listening in. And, of course, they can go to the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com tomorrow and download this wonderful, informative interview. But do you have contact information? Because I'm sure people may want to contact you.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter and on Instagram, and it's both of them are the same, and it's basically at DS8BBALLN. So D as in David, S as in Sam, the number 8, B as in ball, A as in apple, L as in Larry, N as in Nancy. DS8BBALLN on Twitter and on Instagram. And then you can always find my website with my program. You can go to trainnlp.com, and the website will come up, and there's a way to contact on there also.
Two last questions, and you alluded to this early on in the interview when you talked about doing these times and how important it is to have a platform and then utilizing that platform for social change. And, you know, the Muhammad Ali's, the Jackie Robinson's, the Kurt Flood's, the Tommy Smith, and people like that, they did it. Kaepernick is doing it. How important is it for you to see that the NBA players who've done a great job overall use that platform? And I want to start off with a guy who's not African-American, that this guy has really stood up and really, in my opinion, have said the right things, and that's Coach Greg Popovich, man.
Yeah, again, the NBA has always been, has always had an unbelievable foresight, always able to kind of see ahead, always a step ahead, always progressive in their approach to social change, towards involving the players being a part of the business, whether you're a black player or you're a white player. And Coach Popovich has done an unbelievable job being a voice for social change, especially as a white coach. And the NBA, I mean, I'm proud of the NBA. I'm proud of the players, how they always get involved, try to make a stance, use their platform to help with social change. And I think going down to the bubble and incorporating the things that can continue to help with social change into the bubble, I think is a great thing. And I would just encourage, I mean, you don't even have to be an NBA player, whatever. If you're an athlete, non-athlete, I mean, the first thing at the end of the day, your heart has to be in it. You know, your heart has to be in it. And once you realize or know that your heart is in it, whether you're black or white, whether you're Hispanic, once your heart is in it, then, you know, you have to use whatever platform you have, big or small, to make a change. And I think that change should start, it should start in your inner circle. It should start in your family. Start small first. Everybody's process of making social change is different. Everybody's not Dr. Martin Luther King. Everybody's not Kaepernick. Everybody's not LeBron, whatever the case might be. But start in your inner circle to make a change and educate each other and make sure everybody aligns with the same vision that you have for social change, the same thing that your heart has for social change. And if they don't, then you have to make a decision, because one way or another, you're going to have to at some point in time show what side of the fence you're on. You can't straddle the fence. So, you know, just start in your inner circle. Start with acknowledging, start with education, and make sure that you have the people aligned with where you want to go with helping social change, and then you branch out from there. And everybody's process of social change is different, but I'm just proud of the NBA. I'm proud to be a brother of that NBA fraternity. I'm proud of the approach and setting the tone the NBA has done in all types of social justice issues and issues, period. And even with this pandemic. So I think it's very important that the NBA and the athletes continue to use their platform to help keep the social change movement going right now and continue on.
I tell you, man, this has been one of the more informative interviews that I've done. I've been doing radio now for about 24 years, and we've been blessed to interview and have visits with some outstanding individuals and renowned athletes. But I got to tell you, talking basketball and covering so many aspects, this has been one of the best. Leave our listeners with some parting shots. We call it WOW, words of wisdom. Dickie Simpkins, I'm going to be like most of the coaches. I'm going to give you the ball and tell everybody else, including myself, for the next 30, 40 seconds to get out of your way.
All right, everybody get out of the way. Go to the right side of the court and let me have this left side, because I like going left. But I would just tell everybody, man, just whatever gift you've been given in life, try to take that gift and make a change and pass it forward to somebody else to help them. That's one of the big things I try to do. And I would also say that anything you do, whether it's an athlete, whether it's wherever you work, whatever it is you do, try to have a love for what you do and try to do it at a high level and try to do it with detail. A lot of stuff we have going on today, a lot of people are cutting corners, don't have a love for what they do, and don't pay attention to the detail. And then the last thing I would say to walk away with, continue to get the consistent repetition in. If you get the consistent repetition of what you do, the real and correct repetition, then you will instinctively react properly to whatever it is you're doing because you put in the proper reps to create that instinct. And that's all I can tell you.
Well, you said a lot, and I remember what you said early on. It's hard to fail the test when you got the answers.
You got the answers, man. Only a dummy fails the test when somebody's got the answers for you. You just got to open it up, open up, and be ready to get these answers. So,
man, I got the answers, coach.
I know you got the answers, coach. I got the answers. A lot of people are giving the answers, man. So,
well, I tell you what, and I'm blessed to have been inducted into the D.C. Sports High School Hall of Fame a couple of years ago. But, man, certain players that I wanted to coach. And then there were certain players I said, boy, I'm glad I don't coach him. But I always wanted to coach Kurt Smith, and I told him that. And I wanted to coach you because I would have just given both of you guys, as I've done with so many super talented players, just a little bit of parameters. And then I'd say, hey, you don't have the green light, son. You got a blue light.
Coach, you would have had an amazing 1-2 punch right there, Coach.
There's no question about it. No question. Hey, Dickie Simpkins, thank you so much, man. This was awesome. I mean, awesome, man. You are simply one of the best, man. Thank you.
Thank you, Coach, man. Thank you for having me, man. And keep doing what you're doing. I love your platform and how you're bringing people and educating the world out there. So, congratulations to you, Coach, and keep doing your thing. I appreciate you having me on. Anytime you need me.
My pleasure. And, folks, that was awesome. That was our own from the DMV, Dickie Simpkins. And I know you enjoyed it. And I want to thank, as always, our sponsors who make this show possible. And that's Horton's Funeral Services. They're located at Kennedy Street, 600 Kennedy Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 202-829-9000. Ask for Mr. Horton, a.k.a. Ridge Bowman. Now, any dental work, it's Dr. Edward T. Buford, 202-667-8818. And the Athletic Republic, the old run and shoot, and, right off of Marlboro Pike and District Heights, they're going to reopen. So give them a call to find out what the guidelines are. And, hey, you know what? Social distance, but get back in that gym, but give them a call. And also, as always, want to thank my super producer. He is Rick Hampton Sr. And folks, visit theAfricanAmericanAthlete.com. Again, theAfricanAmericanAthlete.com. If you want to hear a replay of this show or any of our past shows, that's where you go to get it. Well, I hope you enjoyed the show tonight, and next week we'll have another big lineup for you, so be ready and be tuned in. But until then, make good decisions, because life is hard, but it's even harder when you do. We'll see you next time!
Listen to a 30-second demo. Go premium to download.